Today, the fake heiress who fooled New York, and a close look at the inequality between London and the rest of England.
Hi, my name is Anna Dalvi. I stayed with you guys until last weekend. I have a question. Can we get a helicopter from the Marrakesh airport to go to Casablanca airport tomorrow night?
This is the voice of Anna Dalvi.
Yeah.
In this video, she's lying on her bed in a dressing gown in one of the most luxurious hotels in Morocco. Her long auburn hair is its usual tousled mess. The young German heiress is trying to order a helicopter to take her to Casablanca.
Bye-bye. You are coming up, you are coming up.
Let me ask you this. How many people have you ever known who are millionaires who walk around handing out $100 bills to the front desk?
I don't know a single millionaire, so I can't actually answer that.
Like, that does not happen. No, people who have a lot of money don't go spending all their money all the time. That is not the habit of somebody who is very wealthy. That's not how they operate.
But Anna is no normal millionaire. In fact, she's not a millionaire at all. She's a con artist. But a con artist who was taking on, with great success, the New York art scene.
It's such a story of our times. You know, she was trying to plug into a scene that is a very au courant scene at this point. You know, it is one based on money, socialites, art contacts, fashion parties.
Anna Dalvi, or Anna Sorokin, which is her real name, has been found guilty of theft and larceny and will be sentenced today. From The Guardian, I'm India Rackson. Today in Focus, inside the Anna Sorokin scam. Anna Dalvi had been a figure on the New York social scene for a few years, but we're going to start her story in 2017 when she checks into 11 Howard, a five-star hotel in Soho.
It's a very cool scene. It's got a very cool restaurant attached to it, the Cuckoo. It's become a hangout for kind of socialites, fashion magazine people.
Hadley Freeman is a writer and columnist for The Guardian. She used to live in New York and has previously covered fashion.
She knew where to go. She knew where the scene she wanted to be in was, and she checked right in.
And what's she doing in New York at this point?
Well, she claimed that she was setting up her Anna Dalvi Foundation, which was something like a 50,000 square foot building that she wanted to lease. That would essentially be an extremely pretentious private members club. I think she called it something like a revolving arts visual dynamic space or something, which is basically word salad. But very credible sounding. I mean, I lived in New York for a long time, and that is the kind of, to be honest, to put it bluntly, that kind of bullshit that you hear from people like that in that area. And you get it here too, in London, of course, with people sort of setting up arts places where very rich people can come and feel like they have a proximity to artists.
She's trying to set up this art foundation, and she's basically moving money using bad checks, forged bank statements between banks in a kind of quest to get to, I think she was trying to raise $66 million.
She wanted to be a member of the party scene. And what she did very cleverly is she got into the art world. Now, the art world right now is a very much a kind of celebrity-based, glamorous, proximity to fashion type world. So art festivals, things like Frieze or the Biennale, the Miami Art Fair, they are as much a part of the social scene as fashion weeks, and maybe even more so. And she knew that, and she clogged right into it.
And how is she presenting herself? Who's she saying that she is?
She was known as Anna Dalvi in New York, but it has since come out, of course, that her real name was Anna Sorokin. And she gave the impression, I don't even know if she ever actually said it, but that she's a German heiress. And she was spending her time going to the right downtown restaurants, the right downtown clubs, Instagramming herself at all the right openings at New York Fashion Week, so that her public image was very much one of a European heiress and socialite around town. She's one of those people that everyone knew, that everyone was used to seeing in places, but she wasn't actually intimate with people.
Right, so who are the people that she's hanging out with?
She didn't have many friends. She was hanging out with Neff Davis, who works in the reception downstairs in Levin Howard. She's hanging out with someone called Rachel Williams, who was a photo editor at Vanity Fair, and Casey Duke, who was a personal trainer. And these are all people who will have connections to the kind of world that she wanted to be into. So either from working for them or else documenting them in the case of Rachel. And she would just take them out for dinner, pay for dinners, pay for clothes.
You mentioned Neff was the concierge at the hotel. She really gets sort of swept up in Anna's world. When does she notice that things aren't quite right?
So she noticed things weren't quite right when her boss said, "We don't have a working credit card on file for this woman."
This was one of the first signs that Anna's finances weren't what they seemed to be. She owed the hotel around $30,000. Through a series of fraudulent loans and bank transfers, she manages to do a wire transfer to cover the first part of her stay at 11 Howard. Weeks go by and the hotel are still chasing her because there's still no credit card on file. Eventually, the hotel changes the code on her room and keeps hold of her stuff. And this is when photographer Jesse Hawke first meets her.
She showed up wearing a black hoodie and very disheveled and pissed off. She was unhappy with whatever was happening back at 11 Howard. That's kind of my introduction to Anna.
Jesse is introduced to her over dinner by his friend Rachel Williams. Rachel is the photo editor at Vanity Fair. She and Anna at this point were very close.
As the night went on, they started talking about they're going to Morocco on Friday.
So when did you get invited on this trip?
Anna asked me if I do any video and I said not really. She said she wanted to know if I'd be interested in traveling with them and following her with a camera. And at dinner, they did tell me, they said, "We're going to Morocco and we're going to stay at the nicest hotel in the world." Mm. And they were like trying to downplay it. At the same time, they were so giddy about it that they couldn't contain themselves.
Were you like, "Oh my God, she must be loaded"?
I thought, well, yeah, when Rachel said, "Well, we're staying in a private villa and it's $7,000 a night." After dinner that night, I was walking Rachel home and she was telling me about Anna and about the place they're staying, and she showed me photos, and it's really, La Mamuña is a pretty extravagant hotel. I mean, it was pretty nice, and so I said, you know, if she can pay for me to go with you on this trip, I'd be happy to go.
So in May 2017, Anna, Jesse, Rachel, and Casey set off from New York.
Anna is the only person I've ever known to board a flight and not bring any of her money with her. She didn't bring credit cards, she didn't bring bank cards, nothing. She put it all in her checked baggage, and that was the most bizarre thing of the trip. And so I remember Rachel was already then buying whatever Anna wanted. She was already spending money.
What was it like arriving at the villa?
Everything is there, and there's a spread waiting for you. Bottles of champagne were being popped. We were celebrating being in Morocco, and, you know, it's like any other girl in her mid-20s who's on social media. It's everyone walking around on their phone taking pictures and videos of the house we're about to stay in for the next week because it's really nice.
What did you all do? How are you kind of spending your days then? Tell us what happened on the holiday.
Just one call.
Cool, yeah.
Okay.
They would arrange some sort of private shopper.
So I'll take this and this right now and this.
Okay.
And then two of those. Not the pink one. Though.
Not the pink
just
one.
The black and okay. The white.
And the private shopper just accompanies you throughout your day to escort them through the markets of Marrakesh, take us to somewhere to eat lunch, places to shop for rugs. There were issues with Anna's card from the very beginning. She never... I just remember anytime we went somewhere and Anna tried to buy something, her card never worked. But nothing was normal about Anna when it came to finances.
What was she like with you on holiday? Did you enjoy spending time with her?
Anna's the most boring person I've ever traveled with.
Wow.
Ever.
Okay.
She looks at social media. She looks at trends. She reads fashion magazines. She speaks to whoever is at whatever hip party or event, and she learns from these people. She's just a chameleon. You know, there are definitely moments where you catch Anna, and she has two iPhones, and she's on both of them, and she's writing nonstop, and I always wondered who she's talking to. And she was either asleep, on her phone, or eating and drinking.
My skin looks very good, too. Well, my skin looks kind of good in every light.
Those are the only four things I ever saw Anna doing.
Well, if you don't want to look vain, you probably shouldn't continue taking selfies, I'm just saying.
Well, I just got it out.
So this holiday has become pretty famous now. At what point did it really come crashing down?
Things progressively over the next 2 days, I think Wednesday and Thursday, things got a little aggressive coming from the hotel. They started asking, you know, where is Miss Delvey? They stopped being friendly. You go from staying at one of the friendliest hotels in the world to suddenly everybody at the front desk is not being friendly.
Do you think she was just very persuasive, charismatic? Why do you think they would have let her stay without that charge?
If you worked at the front desk of a hotel and your client was spending $7,000 a night, that's not the kind of person that you are going to confront or even want to disrupt their stay. So she knew that, and she took that to her advantage. Anytime somebody would question her or talk to her, she would come back to them with an attitude that suggests, I can't believe you're even speaking to me.
When did you all have to leave?
A climax for me was trying to get a ticket out of the country and trying to leave Morocco, because I was told there was a ticket waiting for me at the airport. And after spending 4.5 hours in a car to get to Casablanca, I arrived at a desk with no ticket. You know, I had to buy a last minute one-way ticket out of Morocco. Those aren't cheap.
At the end of the trip, Anna cannot pay the bills, and Rachel ends up footing the charges for everything, a total of $62,000. With the holiday over, Anna keeps reassuring Rachel, who's getting pretty anxious about the money, that she will pay her back. But Rachel isn't the only one she owes.
So she makes it back to New York, and she checks into two different other downtown hotels in New York and skips out on both of them without paying the bill.
Like one after the other.
Exactly. But these hotels, they are cutting onto her tricks quicker.
So what are these tricks? How do you just walk into a hotel and never have to pay anything?
Well, in the case of Love and Howard, it was a new hotel. And so I'm sure there were some teething problems. So, you know, they said there was an oversight that they didn't get a credit card from her when she checked in. And she was acting a part. You know, she was over tipping everybody. She was just wandering in and out carrying designer bags. There is no reason why anyone would think that she wouldn't be good for the bill at the end. Whereas if it had been any average person, if it had been me, you know, looking kind of crappy in, you know, my jeans and my sweatshirt, you know, they probably would have said after a few days, "Madam, are you able to pay for this?" Whereas she was just acting this part, which everybody fell for.
And of course, at this time as well, Rachel is starting to chase her for money. Were you aware of all of that going on?
Yeah, Rachel is concerned about getting her money. I remember Rachel was owed what she thought she was owed, you know, 60-some thousand dollars. It was a big deal for Rachel. It was creating a major problem in her personal life and professional. And this went on for weeks and weeks, and eventually, yeah, somewhere in the middle of those weeks, I remember asking Rachel if she had to be a con artist, and then Rachel assured me she's not a con artist.
Did you see Anna at all in this period?
I did not see Anna when she came back to New York, and I remember Rachel calling me and telling me Anna showed up outside my apartment, or we're going to have Anna come over to Casey's house and we're going to have an intervention because she owes everybody money.
There are numerous attempts by Rachel to get the money. And eventually, in August, she goes to the police. In the meantime, Anna has been charged with several misdemeanors for running out on the two hotel bills, plus a lunch at La Parca Meridian restaurant. With her charges pending, she cashes more bad checks and gets a flight to California, where she is eventually arrested.
What do we know about the alleged scammer Anna Sorokin's true identity?
Wait, Jesse, Anna who? I mean, there is no Anna Delvey. There is no a German heiress. There is no foundation. Anna Sorokin.
So who is the real
Anna Delvey, Anna Sorokin. So Anna Sorokin was actually born in Russia. Her father was a former truck driver, and when she was a teenager, she moved to Germany with her parents and her younger brother. She was living in a small town. She went to normal school. She's quite working class. She wasn't born into money, as she was pretending. And she eventually made her way through Europe, through the kind of European fashion magazine scene, to New York. And the truth is, what's kind of sad about this is people are laughing at her as though she's this kind of Gatsby figure, that she had this fake background. But the truth is, a lot of people who end up in the celebrity world or in this kind of, you know, art world, you know, bogus fashion world type thing, also come from humble backgrounds. Not everyone's going to be an heiress in this world. Not everybody is Poppy Delevingne or whoever. A lot of people have worked their way up, you know, and there's no reason why she wouldn't have fit in if she'd just been honest about herself, and she didn't need to steal to pretend to be in that world. If she had just actually gotten a damn job and worked as fashion assistant at Vogue or wherever, she could have been part of this scene and charmed people.
What have her family said about her decisions?
They're baffled by it. And they say, you know, they always supported her when she went to college and everything. And they're slightly mystified that she's presenting herself as this multi-millionaire heiress.
And now that she's in court, she seems to be keeping up all of those appearances in a way.
You know, she's a 28-year-old young woman who is facing 15 years in prison. That's pretty terrifying. That's, you know, a good chunk of your life gone. And yet she's still maintaining the pose, even though everyone knows the truth.
How has she behaved in court?
She's behaved exactly like Anna Delvey. She's sort of dismissive, bored, unrepentant. She didn't give a statement. And she still insists she was going to pay everyone back. But at no point is it ever explained how she thought she would ever do that.
Is she in a courtroom or at a red carpet event?
And people are completely fascinated with her outfit still.
Making headlines. The 27-year-old defendant showed up wearing a form-fitting black dress with a plunging neckline and choker necklace.
Yes, yeah, so she's still turning up looking like a socialite on trial. Because, of course, she has all these clothes. You know, she did get them.
I mean, interesting that her lawyer, Todd Spodek, kind of arranged a stylist for her for the trial. I mean, is that normal?
Well, it is in some cases. I think like Winona Ryder was styled for her court appearances by Marc Jacobs 20 years ago when she was done for shoplifting. And obviously, Anna is still trying to present an image.
Yeah, speaking of her lawyer, Todd Spodek, when he took to the stand and made his opening statement, what happened?
Her defense attorney says theft wasn't her intention.
So he said she, you know, she's part of a world where you
fake it until you make it. Anna had to live by this.
Which is absolutely true. And that's not just about, you know, the glamorous art celebrity fashion world that she's part of. The thing is that he's kind of glossing over. She wasn't just faking it. She was stealing it until you make it, which is a different problem.
He sort of said, you know, it was an unethical, yeah, unorthodox, sure, but criminal, no.
Well, it's obviously criminal. She was skipping out on hotel bills. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about that. But yes, it's also true that what she was doing on her social media is exactly the same as what most, you know, assistant fashion editors or any of us, to be fair, do on Instagram, which is presenting an idealized image of yourself.
Overnight, a New York City jury finding socialite Anna Sorokin, the so-called Soho grifter, guilty on 8 counts.
In April, a jury found Anna Sorokin guilty on most of the charges against her, including second-degree grand larceny and theft of services. But she was not found guilty for the money Rachel Williams lost. Today, Anna will be sentenced.
I think what people saw in Anna is that if you've ever worked in the fashion world or a magazine publication, it's my understanding and what I've experienced is that if you're a woman in that world, it's kind of a difficult, very catty environment to be in. And there's a hierarchy in the office. And so if you're an average girl and you're working at one of these publications, you know, you're always trying to fit in. You're always trying to be accepted. And Anna, she saw these girls, and I think that's who she befriended. I think she found women who maybe were looking for someone to be their comrade. So I can understand somebody being drawn to Anna. Everybody wants to be included. And that's definitely the drive behind people who became friends with Anna. They felt included in something.
I think, you know, you've mentioned how those women kind of got pulled into Anna's circle. But I suppose she duped
everybody, didn't she? She duped lawyers, she duped bankers, she duped, you know, famous restaurant owners and hotel owners. It wasn't, you know, just women who were worried about their image. She really did hoodwink pretty much everybody.
It's true, yeah. Definitely. She was able to convince people to believe whatever she wanted them to believe. She had a confidence in herself and when she spoke that people didn't question.
I also do think this is should be a kind of a moment of reckoning for certain social circles in New York, London, Paris, Milan, or whatever, about, you know, how they value people based on just their appearances. You know, people wanted her to be a German heiress, therefore they believed it, and therefore they were willing for her to take them out to dinner and pay for their dinners and stuff. I mean, the whole thing is so nauseating and gross. And anyone who's been on the periphery of that circle, as I was, just by covering fashion for this paper and seeing these kind of worlds, you know this world, and you know it is pretty gross. And she has shown a kind of rotten core to it.
There are two productions already underway, HBO and Netflix, on Anna Delvey's story. People just sort of want to gorge on this stuff. We're completely taken by it.
Well, I think people, first of all, they get a sense of validation out of seeing these kind of scams getting their comeuppance. We're so used to people getting away with things at this point, whether they're rich politicians or, you know, kind of dodgy philanthropists or whatever. And here we see people getting their comeuppance. And it's also a way of kind of passing the buck a bit, because we all get fooled by social media. And in here we can laugh at other people who got fooled by social media.
Hadley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow you can read Hadley's column on whether we are in the era of the scam at theguardian.com. Many thanks to her and to Jesse Hawke. And if you want even more on this story, you can read Rachel Williams' account for Vanity Fair and Jessica Presler's article for New York Magazine. Also, our thanks to Eileen Kinsella from ArtNet News. And if you want to watch the clips of Anna Sorokin featured in this episode, head to our programme page. And while you're there, do click on the link for the Listener's Choice Award at the British Podcast Awards. We'd love your vote. Or you can just go to britishpodcastawards.com/vote. Coming up, why there's an ever-growing resentment towards London. Welcome back. Now, The Guardian's Helen Pidd has been reporting on the huge differences between London and the rest of England for a new series of reports called London Versus. It looks at inequalities from health to the arts and from transport to addiction.
I've been The Guardian's North of England editor for 6 years now, and I've noticed an increasing resentment creeping into conversations that I have across the region. You know, I used to live in London, and I still visit regularly, and yet even I often feel that London has become more of an arrogant city-state than a capital city, and increasingly distant from the rest of the country and playing by its own rules. And often it's just the little inequities that grate. You know, I go down to London, I hop on a shiny new Routemaster bus, and I can go anywhere for £1.50. I want to do the same sort of journey in Stockport, my nearest town, and it's £3.50. That really grates. So you have to be a little bit careful when making generalisations about a city of 10 million people, which is home to both some of the richest and also some of the most disadvantaged people in the country. But by certain measures, particularly transport investment and also in terms of health and life chances, Londoners get a far better deal. In the Hartlepool in the northeast, where unemployment last year was at 8.3%, which is higher than anywhere else in England, male life expectancy is now only 76.1 years, and that's actually lower than it was by 1 year in 2010. Compare that to London, where life expectancy is going up and up. If you look at Camden, a London borough that's got, you know, some rich people living there, but also there's quite a lot of social housing, men can expect to live an average 82.3 years. So that's more than 6 years longer than their counterparts in Hartlepool. And this links into another rather worrying pattern we uncovered about depression rates. Now, we all know that no one, you know, however wealthy, is somehow inoculated or immune from the black dog of depression. But statistics show that the neighbourhoods with the highest prevalence of depression are all in the north of England or the Midlands. And the places with the lowest are in the wealthiest bits of London and Kent, as well as the Isle of Scilly. The highest rate of depression is in Brinnington, a suburb of Stockport in Greater Manchester, quite near my house actually, where 23.6% of patients were depressed. And when I went there, I found out that the real rate is actually likely to be far higher. One local GP told me that 61% of the patients he'd seen in the previous 6 weeks were depressed or had previously suffered from the condition. So there are a wide variety of reasons why there are these massive disparities between London and everywhere else. But ultimately, I would argue it comes down to decades after decades of London-centric decision-making. The vast majority of public servants, civil servants, who actually make decisions about people's lives and who have influence over government policy, they're all based in London and they're making decisions about people's lives living hundreds and hundreds of miles away. And that really affects how resources are divvied up. I think that having greater devolution and more key decisions being decided at a local level can only help close the divide between London and everywhere else. But it's got to be meaningful devolution. There's no point appointing mayors who don't really have any power, and that the minute they actually need some real investment for some big projects, they have to go with their begging bowl to the Treasury. So I think if the current government wants to show it's serious about devolving power, then it needs to be ready to let go of the reins and devolve power, real power and money, away from Whitehall.
That's all for today. My thanks to Hadley Freeman, Jessie Hawke and Helen Pidd. Today's programme was produced by Elizabeth Cassin, Rachel Humphreys, Josh Kelly and Gary Marshall. Sound design is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.